Okay, so Schrödinger equation in three dimensions. We're looking at a single particle again. The Schrödinger equation can be generalized as follows. So d psi dt is minus h bar squared onto m nabla squared and the potential. And where this is the Laplacian in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, and as before, if we assume that the potential is time independent, then the general solution is going to be given by a linear combination of the stationary states. So we can write this as follows. Where this is the solution to the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and that's the standard time evolution that we get. And so, in order to figure out what psi of n is, we're going to solve the time-independent Schrödinger equation. And so, if the potential is a function only of the distance from the origin, it makes sense to adopt spherical coordinates. So, I'm going to define these, so r, theta, and phi, in terms of the Cartesian coordinates. And we can define them by drawing a nice diagram where these are our Cartesian coordinates. And then r is the length of this vector. And then phi is this angle from the x-axis. And theta is the angle from the z-axis, or z-axis in Canada. And Australia, actually. So, okay, so in spherical coordinates, let's see how this works. In spherical coordinates, the Schrödinger equation becomes a bit of a mess, so you don't actually have to copy this down. It's going to be in the notes, but I'll write it down anyway so that we can inspect it. So h bar squared on 2m, 1 on r squared, some partial derivatives with respect to r. And also with respect to theta. Okay, And so then the standard approach that physicists always use is to try separation of variables. And so we're going to do that in this case as well. And we're going to begin by splitting this up into the radial component and then also the component that depends on theta and phi. So separation of variables. We write phi of psi of r theta phi is equal to a function of r, and then this function of the angles theta and phi. And so, after some algebraic manipulation, we can rewrite the Schrödinger equation like this. Can you guys see here behind this thing? You can't. Maybe I'll move over to here. So I'm going to get two terms here. One of the terms is going to depend just on the function r, big R of little r. Okay, so that's one term. And then the other term is going to depend just on the angles. And I'm not being explicit about the arguments of y and r, but it should be obvious. Okay, so that's the equation. And so now we can see that it's split up into a component that depends on r and a component that depends on theta. And the only way that this equation can be true, so the sum of these two terms being equal to zero, is that if both of them are a constant and that this one is the negative of that one. And so what we can do is introduce the separation constant like we did yesterday. And in this case, I'm going to call this separation constant L times L plus 1. And it might not seem obvious why you would do this, but some guy did the calculation before and found that that's a nice way of doing it, and it works out. Yep.
Isn't the R square missing the second part of the equation?
R squared sine squared theta.
You have 1 over r squared in the left part, right?
Yeah.
So I guess...
Like at the front?
You multiply everything...
Yeah, I may have missed.
Squared, right?
No, but...
Oh, no,
that
is okay.
No,
then it's good. It's fine.
Okay, cool. Okay, so we've split it up now into two equations and made both of them equal to the separation constant L plus 1. And so at this stage, there's no loss of generality. L could be any complex number, but later on we'll see that L actually must be an integer. And so these two equations have names that we can give them that are rather obvious. So this one is going to be called the radial equation. And this one will be called the angular equation. And you can see that only the radial equation here depends on the potential, while the angular equation doesn't. So we'll solve the angular equation first. So who can suggest a technique for solving the angular equation?
Cite a French mathematician.
No. I heard it here at the front, but Ilya, do you want to say it louder? Yeah, separation of variables. Right. So we've got this function y of theta and phi. And we're going to split this up into a function of theta and a function of phi. And so again, we're going to rewrite the angular equation into two terms, which I'll write down here. So the sum of these two terms is going to be 0. And again, the only way that this equation can be true is if both of these terms are going to be equal to a constant, which we call the separation constant. And in this case, we're going to make that m squared. So we get another two equations that we can solve. And so this second equation is nice and easy to solve. So let's give these numbers. So equation one is going to be simply big phi of little phi is equal to e to the I m phi. And so if we look at a little diagram there, if we go around phi by 2 pi, then we're going to come back to the same location. And so we expect that the value of the function at phi plus 2 pi is going to be the same as the value of the function at phi. So we can say phi, big phi of little phi is equal to big phi of little phi plus 2 pi. And then if we insert this expression into here, we see that e to the I m phi is equal to e to the I m phi times e to the I 2 pi m. And for this to be true, this thing should be equal to 1. Okay, and then this gives us constraints on what this number m needs to be. It's going to be an integer. So it'll be 0, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 2, and so on. And so there are actually two solutions here, but we can account for that by letting m run negative. Okay, so what about the first equation? It's actually quite tricky to solve, and I'm not going to do it in this lecture. I'll just give you what the solution. It's going to be given in terms of associated Laguerre functions, Legendre functions. So there we go, a French mathematician, I guess, whoever said that. Right, okay. The solution to equation two is going to be So where this function p of ml is given by 1 minus x squared as well as a derivative with respect to x to the power of absolute value of m and another function. So this thing is called the associated Legendre function. And then this guy is the Legendre polynomial, which we can define as follows. Correct.
So why does L is an integer? I mean, why do we choose the constant to be L, L plus 1 for convenience? Right?
Yep.
What justifies taking just integer L?
So, I mean, at this stage, L is not an integer. L is only a complex number. But then we find here that this only makes sense. Okay, so I see. I'm going to be using a circular argument here. So there's some complicated stuff going on to arise at this solution. And I'm going to claim that given that solution, you can see that this only makes sense if L is an integer. And so I guess we won't go into the details of that. Yeah. But you preempted what I was going to say. But actually, let me just write down that this is the Legendre polynomial. And this is a polynomial of degree L. So the reason that this equation only makes sense if L is an integer is because a positive integer is because you've got this derivative that you're applying over and over again. A non-negative integer, so it wouldn't really make sense if this was not an integer, and it wouldn't make sense if it was negative.
Don't you have fractional derivatives?
Not that I know. I mean, possibly, but I don't know more. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a mathematician, so I don't know. Do you want to say something more about that, though? Because that's interesting.
No,
okay.
Right. No, you can do that, right? Take d to the power of 2 something, which is where 2 is an irrational number.
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. Okay, so yeah, so there's probably something much deeper going on in here that we're I guess not discussing here. So now if we we made a statement that L is going to be a positive integer and and we can also see that if this value, absolute value of m, is bigger than L, then this function is going to be 0 as well. And that's because this is a polynomial of order L. And so if you act the derivative on it more than L times, this thing goes to 0. So we can also say and it's minus L plus 1 all the way up to L minus 1 and L. And so now we can combine all of this together and normalize it, and we get a result for the angular wave functions in terms of these polynomials, as well as the solution to equation 1 right there. And so here, curly n is a constant, which I'm not going to write down, but it's going to be in the notes. And so for historical reasons, this thing here is known as the azimuthal quantum number. And this guy here is known as the magnetic quantum number. And so we performed this whole calculation under the assumption that V of R was spherically symmetric. And so all of the solutions to the angular equations are going to be the same for any spherically symmetric potential. And in order to solve for the radial part of the equation, so for R, big R of little r, we're going to need to specify the potential. And so it's at this point that we're going to introduce the potential for the hydrogen atom. This is really good, by the way. Where's Jacob? Is he not? Oh, he's not here. Oh, yeah. I'm very impressed with your technique here. So if you guys are ever giving presentations, this like blew me away. You just move from left to right, and it does the appropriate thing. Okay, let's look at the radial equation for the hydrogen atom. So the hydrogen atom consists of a heavy nucleus at the center. So it's a proton that we can consider to be essentially motionless. We can stick it at the origin, and it's going to have charge plus E. And then we'll have a light electron around the outside, charge minus E. And we can define this distance in terms of the radius of this circle. And from Coulomb's law, we know that the potential is going to be given by V of R is equal to minus E squared on 4 pi epsilon naught times 1 on R, where this is the permittivity of free space. And so inserting this potential into the radial equation, we get something that looks like this. once again, solving for R is really, really involved in this case, and we're not going to go through it. I'm just going to give you the solution again. And it's given in terms of these quantum numbers N and L. This parameter rho, which I'm going to define in a second. And the associated Laguerre polynomial. So rho depends on the distance r. A and N, and I'm not sure I've defined A at any point in time. So maybe we'll come back to that.
Is it 1 over R rho to the L plus 1?
Rho to the L plus 1. Yep.
I couldn't see it then.
Is it too small? Okay, so this guy here is the Laguerre polynomial. And this function here is, sorry, this guy is the associated Laguerre polynomial. And LQ is e to the x, another derivative. And so once again, Andres is not going to like my circular argument. But assuming that this is the solution, then we can make an argument for why L needs to be a non-negative integer. What do I do here? You can see that this only makes sense if L is a non-negative integer because we're assuming non-fractional derivatives. And also, L needs to be less than n minus 1 because,
maybe the fact that L has to be an integer comes from the fact that the angular equation is just the angular momentum operator, the norm of the angular momentum operator is squared, right, in the spherical coordinate. We are assuming that that's quantized, then.
But we haven't said anything about the angular momentum operator yet.
But I guess.
So we'll see later on when you solve for the eigenstates of the angular momentum operator, you get exactly the same functions that you need to solve. The same solutions. And so you're right, perhaps it's buried in there. But I think, this is actually very. Interesting, and I think maybe we can try and touch on it on Friday. I'll have a bit more of a think about if there is anything deeper to be said about where all of these restrictions come from.
Why do you have the 2p? What is that indicating?
Two row.
So maybe. L is a function of 2 row?
L is a function of 2 row. So my rows are not very nice. Yeah. Yeah, Brady.
In your second equation, L2, you have d dx to the p.
I do, yes.
But p isn't an index on L2.
Yeah, okay, so that might be a typo. Yep. Thanks, Brady. Okay, so. Yeah, that would make sense. But I didn't write it down here, and so I don't quote me on that, but I believe it would be the ball radius. Yeah. Okay, so what did we say? The restrictions on L should be that L is going to be 0, 1, 2, and minus 1. And then, right, and we can combine all of this together to write down the functions for... Yeah, we can combine all of this together to write down the wave functions for the hydrogen atom. So we get psi of n ln. Some normalization factor, which I won't write down, but again, it's going to be in the notes. And the Laguerre polynomials again. And the corresponding energies are going to be like this. Okay, and so, I mean, it's like a bit of a mess, but they're really beautiful. I'm sure you guys have seen what these solutions look like. I kind of had a practice drawing them freehand yesterday, and it didn't go so well, but maybe I'll try to draw a couple. But I mean, this, like, to me, this is one of the most amazing things, that you get these functions just by solving this equation. It's really cool. So, okay, I mean... An obvious one to draw would be the spherical one. So it looks something like. Okay, that should pass for a sphere. And then there are some other cooler looking ones, like this one. And then let's try this one as well. So these are surface plots that I'm drawing of the probability densities. Yeah, this one's the one that I kind of had the most trouble with, but we'll see. It's what?
Dxy orbital?
Oh, yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but... So I'm going to guess that's like a p orbital, and I don't know which one this is. Yeah. But anyway, that's really cool, I think. Right, okay, so then for the next part of the lecture, I want to move on to looking at eigenstates of the angular momentum operator. Okay, so we saw here that the stationary states of the hydrogen atom are labeled by these quantum numbers N, L, and M. And so it turns out that L and M are also related to orbital angular momentum. So let's kind of start from a classical definition of angular momentum. We know that it's given by R cross P. And this means that L of X is equal to Y P Z Z P Y. And we can use we can just permute the indices to get all the other guys. Okay, and then to figure out what the corresponding operators are, we just make the substitution for the momentum operator. So here, J can be X, Y, or Z. And so after we make the substitution, it's easy to calculate what the commutation relationships are for LX, LY, and LZ. And so we get LXY is I on H bar LZ. And then we can also permute all the indices to get the other guys. And so these things are the fundamental commutation relationships, relations for angular momentum, and everything else is going to follow from them. So let's say, okay, so the fact that these don't commute means that the LJs are not going to be compatible observables. And it means that we can't find simultaneous eigenstates of any two of them. But it's useful to do that, to find simultaneous eigenstates of two operators in order to use an algebraic approach to solving for these eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. So we're going to identify another operator that does commute with the LJs. And so this operator is going to be the total angular momentum. And so then our approach is going to be to try and find simultaneous eigenstates of both this operator, L squared, and one of the other operators, Lx, Ly, or Lz. And we're going to take Lz in this case. So we want to find simultaneous eigenstates of L squared and the Z component of L. So let's write down the eigenvalue equations. So we want to find out what the lambdas and mu's are, as well as the functions f. Okay, so we're going to use an approach that's analogous to the algebraic approach we used to solve the harmonic oscillator. So we're going to define these operators L plus and L minus, which can be written in terms of Lx and L, Ly. So let's define these. And then we can use these operators to show that L plus or minus acting on the wave function, the eigenfunction, is going to also be an eigenstate of L squared and Lz. So we can show that L squared on L plus or minus F gives us the same eigenvalue lambda, and for Lz we get an eigenvalue that is different by plus or minus H. Yes, Saad?
Hi, yesterday you said that the motivation for using A plus and A minus was the fact that we had a Hamiltonian that was of the form U plus B times U minus B.
Yeah.
So what's the motivation here? Is it similar? And if it is, I don't see where.
The motivation is that it works. So, I mean, like, when you do research, you usually take a stupidly ridiculous route to find out what the answer is. And then when you present the answer, you present it in a very logical way. So I imagine people who derived this did some pretty silly things to begin with, and then eventually found a nice way that actually works and, you know, demonstrates what's going on. So let's just say that the motivation is that it works. Okay, so we can now call these guys the lowering and raising operators for this function f. So if we act L plus on f, we get an eigenvalue of Lz that is increased by h bar, and if we act L minus, we get an eigenvalue that's decreased by h bar. So we get this ladder of eigenstates again, and each, you know, rung on the ladder is separated by h bar. So we know that the rungs on these ladder can't go to infinity in both directions, because at some stage there's going to be an eigenvalue of LZ that can't be bigger than the eigenvalue of L squared, since that's the total eigenvalue. So if you think about it geometrically, you know, the Z component of something can't be greater than the length of that vector. So we can define the highest possible eigenstate and also the lowest possible eigenstate. And we define them in terms of the actions of the lowering and raising operators. So there's a top rung where if we act L plus on this function ft, we're going to get 0. And similarly for the bottom one, if we act L minus on the bottom one, we're going to get 0. And so we can define eigenvalues for these guys. Which I'm going to call LH bar and also L bar H bar. And so then we can write these two eigenvalue equations. So this is for the top rung, and then we can do the same thing for the bottom rung as well. And then the next step is to we want to find a relationship between this operator L squared and this operator LZ, and we can do this in terms of the lowering and raising operators that we raised before. So a very useful thing is to evaluate this product L plus or minus times L minus plus. And if you do that, you get a relationship between L squared, this product that you defined, and then LZ, which is what you're interested in. And so now using this, you can insert that back into these equations here. So let's call these equation 3 and equation 4. In doing so, we find that that lambda is going to be equal to h bar squared L plus 1. And that's going to be equal to h bar squared L bar plus 1. So you can see if I stick this into this expression and then using what we know about how L plus or minus acts on here and how LZ acts on here, we get this relationship. And so this is nice because now we can make a statement about how L relates to L bar. And there are two possible solutions that that could be true. So the first one, either you could have that L bar is equal to L plus 1. Alternatively, you could have L is equal to minus L. And so which one of those do you think is the physical solution? The second one. Why not the first one?
Because
because it works. Jacob?
Means it's higher in the top row.
That should be greater than above.
Yeah, so L is the top rung, right? So L can't be, if this were true, then L bar would be greater than L. And we know that's not true because L bar was the lowest rung. So this one's not true. And we find that L is equal to minus L.
L bar is equal to minus L?
L bar is, yeah. Good. Okay, so this means that the eigenvalues of LZ are going to be some number m times h bar, where m is going to go from minus L to plus L. And that's going to happen in integer steps of n. And so, let's just write this down. Okay, I'm going to try and rush through this relatively quickly. Okay, so if that statement is true, then we know that L is going to be equal to minus L plus N, and then L has to be equal to N on 2. So that means that L could be an integer or a half integer. So does anyone have a problem with that statement, that L could be an integer or a half integer? No. Okay. I expected you would. You've got.
Yeah, I have a problem with.
Yeah. No, we can come back to that. Yeah. But it turns out. Actually, let me write down the eigenfunctions first. Okay, so I've made a statement about the eigenvalues, but now we would be interested in finding out what these eigenfunctions are. And to do that, we want to rewrite the operators L squared and LZ in terms of spherical coordinates. And I won't write down what those equations are because we find that they're equal to the equations that we found before. So both of the angular equations. So one of them is going to be equal to the azimuthal equation, and the other one's going to be equal to the angular one. And so what we find is that the solutions to here are going to be the spherical harmonics that we got for the hydrogen atom. And so when we actually solved for the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, we inadvertently solved for simultaneous eigenstates of these three operators, H, L squared, and LZ. So let's just write that down. But the eigenstates F, L, M are the spherical harmonics. But does anyone remember what the constraints were on L when we solved for the spherical harmonics there? They were integer. And meanwhile here, at least when we were looking at the eigenvalues, we found that L could be an integer and a half integer. And so it turns out in this case, when we're dealing with this angular momentum, so orbital angular momentum, the solutions that correspond to L equals half integers are not valid solutions because they don't have valid eigenfunctions. The eigenfunctions are only defined for integer Ls. So what are these weird half integer values then? Spin, right. And so even though at the moment we're talking about orbital angular momentum, it turns out that the algebraic expressions for spin angular momentum are just exact copies of the ones for the orbital angular momentum. So in the next, I guess, 15 minutes, I'll just talk a little bit about spin.
I get a quick question. Are you basically saying that the spin doesn't, let's see,
Okay.
So that the eigenstates of half integer spin can't be represented on L2 or on square integral functions?
No, they're not represented using the spherical harmonics.
So the spherical harmonics only allow integer values of L.
Right, but could we write them down as normalizable wave functions?
Well, the fact that we didn't find them to be solutions when we solved for the hydrogen atom would imply that no, you can't. Yeah. Yes, Andres.
Okay. I have the eigenvalue problem, right? I can find eigenstates for half integer L independent of whether it's angular momentum or spin, right? But when you're talking about the orbital angular momentum, what do you mean by that? I mean you're taking the operator's L set and L squared in spherical coordinates, and the only way that equation can have a solution is that L is.
So when you write it in spherical coordinates, you just get exactly the same equations that we solved already for the hydrogen atom. Yeah.
So how does writing it in spherical coordinates then takes out the possibility that L can be a half integer?
No, you have a spherically symmetric potential. You solve for a spherically potential that is radially symmetric. When you use those conditions, you arrive at the conclusion via your differential equation that L must be an integer. Consequently, those solutions are only applicable for representing the angular momentum eigenstates and orbital angular momentum. The spin angular momentum eigenstates are not covered by these spherical harmonics.
That's exactly what he said.
Right.
So, I mean, In general, depending on depending on what the form of L is. If L is the orbital angular momentum operator, then it just turns out that you don't have these solutions. So even though the algebraic technique shows that they could possibly exist, once you specify what the form of this is, you find that you just don't get these solutions for these wave functions. And I guess to get to this point, we were being a little bit more general. Even though we had relationships between LZ and the raising and lowering operators, it wasn't the whole story. So for the spin case, we have all of the same relationships. And so we find that we have exactly the same eigenvalue equations. But then things are a little bit different because the actual operators that we're dealing with are different in form, even though they have similar relationships, or in fact the same relationships between them.
Were you going to write out a term, a Hamiltonian, for the case you were working with before, which has a term in it which doesn't allow these half integer solutions? Is that...
Am I going to write down the Hamiltonian for...
If you wrote out the Hamiltonian for this hydrogen acting,
yep,
in terms of these L's, it would look in such a way that these half integer solutions gave you zero or something?
I don't know how to answer that question.
Because the operators don't check. It doesn't matter how you put the representation you use for the operators, how you write them out, if they are the operators that you've written there, unless you change them, in which case.
Well, I mean, so I'm going to change them in the sense that I'll replace L with S, and all of the relationships between all of the L's are going to be the same as the relationships between all of the S's.
And derivation we've done here must be
valid. That derivation will definitely be valid. Until I specify the form of L. And then when I try and solve for the functions, that'll change. So at this point, there's nothing that rules out the half-integer ones until I put in the specific form. And so we find that in the spin case, we don't get anything that rules out these half-integer solutions. Yes?
So you get rid of the half-integer solutions when you choose the Dirichlet. You say I'll use some differential operator that acts on phi. That's where you get rid of the n. But you could just as well have said, oh, you know, LZ is not a differential operator that acts on this space. You could have just said, you know, I'll invent, which is what you're going to do for spin. Like, you'll invent the eigenfunctions who will have the half integer eigenvalue.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, this is not the rigorous way of deriving these solutions. There are much more elegant ways of doing it in terms of generators of rotations, and they're probably a lot more rigorous. But this was hopefully, well, I tried for this to be an intuitive, a plausible motivation for why we get what we get here. Yeah, I only have a couple of minutes, so maybe it makes sense to leave the spin stuff until later, until tomorrow. But pretty much what I was going to do is, without motivating the algebra for the spin operators, I was going to say that they're the same as they are for the orbital angular momentum operators, and then I was going to show what the eigenstates are for those guys. And they're no longer going to be functions. They're going to be these two-dimensional vectors. And I guess you guys have seen all of this, how you can write all of the operators in terms of the Pauli matrices and everything. But I'll just briefly go over it at the beginning of tomorrow's lecture. So for now, yeah, let's finish. Thanks.